All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Also, Gibson Guitars. Only a Gibson is good enough. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Berlindy. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. It is our 299th episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. I probably should think of some star-studded, all-star 300th episode plan, but right now I'm just too busy interviewing folks for this podcast. I got to figure out who is going to be lucky number 300, but you can stay tuned till next week and find out. Today on the show, returning guest Adam Miller, one of my favorite guitarists. I encourage everybody who doesn't know who he is to go back and listen to the first podcast we did with Adam, where we talk about him growing up in Australia, the influence of Tommy Emmanuel, some of the cool guitars that have passed through his hands. But today on the podcast, we're talking about his new record, Unify, which came out in August and thoroughly blew me away. If anybody out there loves the jazz guitar of John Scofield, or just loves that kind of plugged-in electric live jazz sound that's got some energy behind it, I encourage everybody to go check out Unify. And Adam went above and beyond. He actually turned in a video just for our listeners and our readers, which is available now on fretboardjournal.com. And it's just him and his cherished partscaster and a champ, and it is about as cool as it gets. So thank you, Adam, for sending that. We appreciate it. Before we get to Adam, we have a couple of sponsors I got to give a shout out to. Of course, monocreators.com is where you can read up on all of Mono's gig bags and studio monitor stands and pedal board bags and pedal boards. Adam talks about his Mono during this podcast, and I think you will agree it is one of the great companies for protecting your stuff, and their gear is just so ergonomic and so bulletproof. I encourage everyone out there, I know no one's touring right now, but if you're preparing yourself to tour again, check out all of Mono's offerings. Our other sponsor is our friends over in New York City at Retrofret Vintage Guitars, who consistently, I don't know how they do it, every week they get the coolest guitars I see at any guitar store anywhere. Right now, a 16-inch block inlaid 1934 Gibson L5, the classic Gibson L5 shape and body, but with the fancy block inlays. They have a 1971 Marden D18 available right now. I'm assuming that's someone's birth year guitar, someone listening to this podcast. And the cream of the crop, for me at least, a 1956 Harmony Stratotone Newport H42-2. It's got the neck through construction, the D-arm in pickup, but it is in metallic green paint, and it is a thing to behold. Such a beautiful, cool guitar. I want that guitar. Go to retrofret.com, sign up for their new arrivals email, check their new arrivals page, because you will learn a lot about guitars and you may find yourself falling in love with a guitar like I just did with that Harmony Stratotone. What else can I tell you? Fretboard Journal's 46th issue is now mailing. I'm very happy to say that. As these things go, it's September 20th right now. Folks are going to start seeing Fretboard Journals a week from now, and they're probably going to continue to start seeing them 3 weeks from now because the Postal Service is not firing on all cylinders. But rest assured, if you are a print subscriber, you don't need to hold a vigil at your mailbox. Just wait. It'll show up in its protective envelope. And it is quite an issue. It is the start of our 15th anniversary year. And rather than just do a 15th anniversary issue, we're going to do four issues. The entire run, 2020, 2021 issues are going to be kind of a little unique, slightly different design, more features than you're used to, more photos than you're used to, and you're already used to a lot of that stuff. So we're pulling out all the stops. This issue has John Leventhal and Roseanne Cash in it, an incredible oral history tribute to Hubert Sumlin. It's got a feature on luthier Steve Grimes, who is creating some of the coolest archtops and mandolins and ukuleles imaginable from his home in Maui. On and on, a bunch of great stories. Mark O'Connor's return to flat picking guitar. He went to the fiddle for so many years, and then he returned to his Martin, that he was originally known for when he was a kid, and it is such a cool story. I think this issue is so great. If you are not a subscriber yet, I'm not going to shame you. You can subscribe now and get this issue in either digital form or print form instantaneously, really. Go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the subscribe tab, even use the coupon code podcast when you check out, and I will take $5 off of your order just for listening to this podcast. And I don't really have much else to report. We have a great print issue ahead of us with Fretboard Journal 47. I am hard at work on it right now, and we have so many cool podcast guests coming up on this podcast. So if you haven't subscribed to it yet, please go over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you do that and click on the subscribe tab for that as well. And Adam Miller, the album is called Unify. You should go check it out. It is truly great. I loved it. So much cool energy. It was so much fun hearing how he did it too. So enjoy the podcast. Thank you all for all the kind words and feedback at podcast@fretboardjournal.com, and we'll keep them coming. So Adam, you and I, you came to the Fretboard Journal sometime between a year ago and 10 years ago. The days all kind of blur together right now.
It was last year.
Obviously, you have this new record, Unify, that I want to talk about, but a lot has changed in the last year, both globally and with you. I feel like you were well on your way to becoming like an LA session jazz guitar great, and obviously COVID maybe derailed that. But tell me what your plan was a year ago. Let's start there.
Well, my plan a year ago was really just finally trying to give the US a decent shot, because I'd been like traveling back and forth touring for I think 10 years at that point. I was trying to just see how things would change if I was actually in the US, because Americans think Australia is a really long way away in general. Even though it's like I can be there tomorrow. Well, you know, a year ago I could be, not now. Yeah. But, you know, and that was always my thinking, that it was like, well, yeah, just call me, I'll come. And, you know, flights you could get relatively cheap and it was easy. But I realized people didn't think that way. So, yeah, I just wanted to sort of take it on before I was too old and too scared.
Yeah. So you did move up here, sort of.
Yeah, so we were living in, like, well, we were in the U.S. for, 7 months straight, then came back to Australia, and then I was back in the U.S. for another 2 months touring around, came back to Australia, came and recorded a record in December.
This record?
Back in Australia, yeah, back in Australia for Christmas. And then I was back for NAMM and then came back again just to, you know, basically finalize packing everything up here and getting out long term.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was still a lot of international travel last year, but it was predominantly in the US. And, you know, we had a place lined up in LA that we were moving to in March, which was really cool because we hadn't had a place of our own for almost 2 years at that point, because we'd just been traveling so much and in and out. So yeah, that was going to be really exciting to sort of have a little base for a little while.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw you at that, not this last NAMM, but the NAMM prior, you did the Gitaco thing, which was amazing.
Yeah. Yep.
So you obviously had this sort of network brewing of fellow musicians to tap into and everything. So was this going to be like your coming out party with Unify? You're going to tour for it and do all that jazz?
That was the plan, yeah. And especially being the first album that I'd recorded in the US. Actually, the first album I hadn't recorded in like Newcastle, Australia, actually. So it was sort of that, there was a lot of steps being taken there and leaps from my point of view, and even just control, because I still mix this album, and Justin, the drummer that played on it, he recorded, like, we just sort of set it up together. We didn't really have that many discussions, which was why I recorded it with him. But I, you know, not doing it in my studio and me not being the person that set up all the microphones was a bit of letting go for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Record's incredible. I mean, we can dive into it now if you want, but
yeah,
what is such a rare thing is to hear, I don't know how to phrase this without insulting someone I know, but they won't know who I'm talking about. But your recording, your album, it has that sort of beauty, but it also has that sort of live grit, energy, soul behind it. And I'm curious how that came to be, because it doesn't happen naturally with a lot of records with guitar virtuosos.
Yeah, true. Look, that's something I work really hard on. And a lot of it does come down probably to the fact that most of my shows, I've never really succeeded in the whole guitar scene or the jazz scene yet. So like, or any scene, maybe, if I'm being honest. But like at home in Newcastle, like the gigs that I would play regularly here were just in front of anyone in the corner of pubs. So I'd be doing this same material and just trying to get it across to everyone. And I think that has always, like, I tried to get that out of my playing for a long time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I would, and, but I think it's led to just this sort of uniqueness to it, this thing of trying to make things right, but then not to the nth degree.
Sure.
If that makes sense. And with this record, you know, the idea was to track it totally live, and the bass and drums are, and I did play everything, but, you know, in control, and I really actually just wasn't happy with the guitar tone I pulled in LA. The playing was pretty all right, but it just didn't quite sound like me. Actually, I think the sound I pulled was even more like fuzzy.
Wow.
And raw, and it was too much for me. So I, over Christmas in Australia, actually re-recorded all the guitar.
Oh, wow. Crazy.
I'm biting my lip now. Yeah, no. Just going. So, yeah.
Same guitar, anyway. Though? Same actual guitar?
Yeah, pretty much. I used three guitars on the album. So I took two of them to LA. So there was one extra one that got a bonus look in because it was... Yeah, because I had access to it.
Okay. What were the guitars?
Okay. So most of the album is my Nick Huber Rietbergen, which is now an Adam Miller signature model because people started ordering it.
Nice.
Which is amazing. Yeah. So it's it looks like a 335, but it's a giant Tele, really. So it's a giant hollow body mahogany Tele.
Cool.
With a redwood top, and it's got two gold foils in it, which is, you know, the official Fretboard Journal favorite pickup.
It kind of is sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So so that guitar is most of the album. Then a couple of tracks are my Tele parts caster that I built.
Yep.
And so it's, I built it years ago, and it's an MJT body that I bought on eBay,
mm-hmm.
and it's hollow as well, and it's got a solid rosewood neck, which is part of the awesomeness of it. I got that from Warmoth, and yeah, and the other guitar I played was a Ryan Thorell archtop that Ryan built for me a couple of years ago, which is an overhaul, very much an acoustic archtop. And so, yeah, when I recorded that, I'd mic it up and also play it through my two rock. And it's the mix of those on a few songs.
Wow. For folks who have never seen you, And I'm sure there's a correlation here. You're the guy at guitar shows who is always smiling and always has ridiculously nice guitars you're carrying
around. Oh, really? Well, yeah. Look, and, you know, when I was at the Fretboard Journal last time, I had a loan of one of Ken Barker's guitars. Exactly. So that is, you know, just sort of insane, those sort of things. But I, you know, as far as guitars go, like, I'm always... I just find them so amazing. I'm just so into guitars. Like, I fall asleep at night looking at reverb, or actually, like, the last few weeks has been browsing Warmoth of dreaming up parts casters, just things I could create in different pickups. And yeah, so for quite a long time, I've just had this super interest in just the instruments themselves and, you know, how minute changes can make you play differently. And yeah,
so there might be a new guitar build in the works.
Not yet. No, we've got to move first. There's too much. Yeah, there's already too much gear.
Have you met? Pardon me if I asked you this before. Have you met Anthony at Harvester?
I have not, actually. No, Anthony is in Melbourne,
Ways away.
Which is like. Yeah, it's 12 hours drive from me. And like the guitar community in Australia, like, there's not so many of these consistent, like, you know, sort of events.
Yeah.
So there's no, like, you know, there's no equivalent to NAMM show in Australia anymore. There used to be. There's one guitar festival sort of called the Melbourne Guitar Show. And... But it sort of ends up mainly being like retailers and things. It's not, the little guys don't really. I did see one of his guitars once there, but I haven't met him. Yeah.
Got it. Mm. So is it safe to say this record is kind of a song cycle of sorts, just by going off of the song titles? I mean, you did name a song after one of our favorite contributors, which is an automatic... Mm. Invitation to get on the Fretboard Journal podcast, everybody. But this record's actually good, so you got the invitation, even if you hadn't named a song after Adam. But
yeah, nice.
But is it biographical? Is it about the move?
Yeah, totally. I haven't done the you know, the, what's the word, the I've lost it. But you know, the made up story album, the
concept
fiction
album,
sort of, yeah, the fiction concept album, yet. But this one, it just sort of flowed out as I, you know, was preparing to move to the US and going through things and inspired by just different music and different people I was hanging around. So, yeah, the songwriting side of it, I think is, I'm really proud of it, actually, just, and I think it sort of did, it captures that progression of last year pretty well. And even though, like, there's still a fair bit of, like, sort of stylistic variation through it all, but it all sort of does fit together as a package, which I hadn't really planned. It was just like, well, I've got these songs and let's just get them recorded quick and then think about it later.
Yeah. Since I brought it up, what was the story behind the Adam Levy song?
Oh, well, Adam's been a friend of mine for many years now. I don't know when I first harassed or met him. It would have been harassing. It would have been at one of his gigs, probably in New York. But we just became friends, and he's one of two US friends that's actually been to my house in Australia.
Oh, wow.
So that's sort of like a big deal. And we did a show together in Newcastle. Oh, it was quite a while ago now, like 6 years, 7 years maybe. And it was super fun to be able to, you know, have him on my turf, I guess, and just to present him to, you know, the people that are used to seeing me. But, so he's always been an inspiration, and not just musically, like, just life as well. Like, I really loved how, I guess from a career point of view, that Adam did so much diverse stuff, like writing, and, you know, then he'd be doing these huge shows with huge artists, but then he's playing the tiny little bar, whether it's in New York or, you know, since he moved to LA.
Yeah.
Like, just, yeah, all those things. And I found that really inspiring, like, just to go, oh, you don't just have to do one thing. And, you know, I always wanted to live in New York. And I think even when Adam moved to LA, even though he's moved back to New York in the last few weeks,
exactly.
It opened my eyes to go, oh, maybe LA is a thing. I don't know. So he's just influenced me in so many ways. The song specifically was this cool thing that was happening in LA last year, which was run by Joshua Ray Gooch. So he's, you know, most famously Shania Twain's guitar player.
Okay.
And he ran this, I guess, sort of like the Guitarco thing as well. He ran this jam thing every Thursday at 10 a.m. at a boba tea store. Like, you know, people in Australia don't even know what boba tea is. And
oh, bubble tea.
Yeah.
Bubble tea. Yeah. Okay. It took me a second there. I was thinking of exotic teas. Okay.
No.
Like
no.
In a strip mall? Like a mall tea, bubble tea shop?
It's sort of a little bit hipper than that.
Okay.
Like, it's not quite in a strip mall, but, you know, it's still boba tea. And,
yeah.
You know, I can't say boba without putting on a Californian accent.
It's okay.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it was just every Thursday he would run these things, and they weren't open jams. Like, you'd get invited to play, and it was the 4th of July last year. I did one with Josh. Adam played guitar. I play guitar. Kerry Franks was on keys. Nick Campbell was on bass, and Garrett Tillman was on drums. And I sort of knew everyone, so it was sort of cool, like, that I'd already had this sort of rapport with everyone. And it was a really weird day. It was super hot, and an earthquake happened after the first song, like a big one.
Okay.
And we were outside, so it was I was thankful for the fact it was outside. But, like, the whole, you know, LA just rocked like a boat for 10 seconds. And so it was really amazing, because we just played this first song, and it was like, everyone was like, wow, that came together insane. It wasn't like your normal, you know, jam song. It was this beautiful, flowy, you know, sort of like a Frizzell album thing, just floated along, and it was perfect. And then we all got to the end and looked at each other, and then the ground shook. So it was really special.
It's like, you made it. You made it to LA.
Yeah,
you got your earthquake experience in.
Yeah. And then one of the songs later, Adam played the four, you know, the main four chords of that song. That was the jam he started, which was like F major 7 to E 7, A minor to C 7. And I don't know. I loved it. I just checked it wasn't a song that Adam was working on or something that was his. And then it was sort of, and just because I just kept building on it from there and just adding more things, and definitely, like, inspired by Adam's songwriting, like the changes as well. And then it was always the working title, like in the set list. It's like, oh, the Adam Levy song. And then by the time the album came around, it was just like, well, that's the title. It is Adam Levy.
That is funny. When did you break the news to him?
I'm trying to think. It would have maybe December. I think when I was recording the album, we met up with him and his wife, Ritsko, for dinner. And yeah, I think then, hey, do you mind if I actually call this song that now? Because this is what it is. So, yeah.
That's fun. He's the most humble, zen-like guy ever. I'm sure that he had a long gaze at you.
Yeah, I've never really got an honest response from him about it. I felt a little bit bad, like, when I was starting to promote it, because it was the first single. I was like, man, I'm saying Adam Levy and not a lot right now.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. But, yeah.
I mean,
that's just what it was. And I, you know, I feel like it does sort of personify him in a little way. Like everyone that hears it, that knows Adam, goes, yeah, it's like, just sounds like Adam coming in for a big hug.
Yeah. You mentioned the drummer doing the lion's share of the recording. One of the coolest things about this record is it's your record. It's your playing and your compositions, but the rhythm section is so strong and just so prominent. How did you meet these guys? And tell me about it.
Well, this is the whole beauty of this story, is that Justin Glasgow was the drummer, and we recorded it in his studio. He was the drummer on the Guitar Co. night last year.
Okay, yeah.
I'd never met him before, and we just got along really well. And because on that gig, we actually played a few of my songs, and he really enjoyed those. So when I came to finally getting some trio shows in LA, I just called him first. And that's how it started. And he introduced me through another, like, underground LA jam thing. This was just in a garage. It wasn't a public thing. To Joel Gottschalk, who, like, toured with Philip Sace for many years.
Okay.
And does a lot of the musical theater, or did, in LA. So, you know, I have a few musical theater friends here, and there was a live TV version of Rent, the musical, and he played bass on that. And and he's just been super busy with that since sort of basing himself more in LA. So those guys were already friends, and but they'd never actually done a gig together before. So it was really nice to sort of bring them together to start to play. And we're all similar age, and we just get along really well. So it was just really easy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you, I know that there was like, in the timeline, there were some trips back to Australia, but from the moment when you first decided to give LA a chance to when, I guess, COVID hit and you had to stay home, did your playing evolve? Like, did you find your playing different in LA than you would have back in Australia?
Yes. I think one of the hard things, and it comes, like, talking earlier, like, with this sort of rawness and attitude thing, is that, and it's just because these are the things I book, because I sort of like the challenge as well. My shows in Australia are often fighting against the crowd. They're not in environments where I should be playing. Does that make sense? Like, it should be like a band playing AC/DC covers.
Okay.
But I play my instrumental stuff there. So at some point, just because of the volume of the room, I'm always playing more rocky than I probably really want to.
Sure.
Just because I know it'll, you know, get people back in. Whereas, it was just because I was in LA, and I'm like, well, there aren't gigs like that. And so everything I did in LA was pretty much my own show, and I'd worked my butt off to get it. And that people were there to see me play. I could just be more free and dynamic and just sort of, I guess, play the way I'd always dream I play in my head.
Yeah.
And it just allowed me that to explore space a little bit more regularly. Whereas I think just because so many of my shows, like, trio wise in Australia, had always been this thing of, like, there are some when I'm on tour, but touring in Australia is only like 3 or 4 dates. Like, you don't do anymore. There aren't any more cities with a club to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So being in LA, and then when I was touring overseas, most of my stuff was solo, which is then a whole different ball game. So finally getting to be able to play with a trio and play with people sort of more regularly, just let me find space easier, which is something, that I always wanted more in my playing, but just never really got the chance to do it.
I'm sure you're back home playing a ton solo by yourself and practicing all the time. Is it translating to that playing as well, or did you have to kind of leave that dynamic in LA?
No. It's definitely stuck with me now. And even more so in my solo playing. For those that don't know, like, I grew up touring a lot opening for Tommy Emmanuel,
yes,
which is, you know, just powerhouse, and you're just going a million miles an hour. And then I got super, like, into Charlie Hunter and that groove thing and being able to play everything at once. And I guess as I've just got older, I'm just trying to translate how to play things solo without having to think I have to be the whole band anymore, that there is beauty in just having one note at a time.
Yeah.
Right. And still having like the dance of it and being really super critical of how, where your note placement sits, so that, you know, the listener almost hears more than I'm playing anyway.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
So, and especially when you've got no audience feedback via Instagram Live, like, you're just there going, hey, it's then a super exercise of going, yeah, I really don't know what's going on or how people are reacting to this. So
it's a surreal time.
It's pretty weird. Like, you don't realize, because there's no downtime when you do these live stream things, especially when they are live.
Yeah.
You just sort of there, and you, like, as soon as you stop a song, there's no downtime. You can't really scratch your nose, or, you know, I've learned to just, like, have a cup of tea with me, because I don't think that looks that weird for me to sip a cup of tea after I finish a song.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just realize, I was doing quite a few of them for a while, even just for the challenge of getting used to it. And I'd be exhausted after them. I'd just be so worn out. It's one-way conversation for an hour.
Yeah, they are so awkward.
Yeah.
how else are you filling your time? What else are you up to? Are you still biking a lot?
Yes, definitely biking. We can talk bikes for sure. That's one of the things that's really hard when I've been traveling, and even when we're moving back to the US, was like going, okay, well, I'm not going to have a bike anymore, because, I do mountain biking. So my bike is not the one you pick up at the yard sale for $10.
Sure.
But it's, you know, not having that outlet was really actually starting to scare me. And I was riding so much just before we were leaving to do it. So, I've just been spending lots of time doing that again. And I was really serious when I was a teenager. Like, my little sporting claim to fame was I was ranked first in Australia in downhill as a junior, you know, for a few weeks.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, but downhill in the 90s is not like now.
Okay.
You know, it was a very different sport. But yeah, it's just so nice to do something where I don't look at my phone. I take it with me just in case I have a fall and can't get up.
Mm-hmm.
But just to have that space away from things is so amazing. And in Newcastle, where I live, it has a pretty strong mountain biking history, which is weird because we don't really have mountains in Australia. But there's this mountain bike trail that's on the beach. It's like a national park, and it's overlooking the ocean, and it's in the middle of the city. It's just crazy. So from where I'm living right now, it's 10 minutes to ride there, and then I'm in these trails that have been designed by all World Cup course designers, and it's just beautiful.
Well, I'm glad you have that. Everybody needs an outlet like that, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's a little silly. Like, I have already broken a rib whilst in isolation. You know, a bit of shoulder damage and things, but actually, no, I think the shoulder damage was from taking my guitar on and off the other week.
How did you break a rib?
I broke a rib just in a measly crash on my bike, just hit the ground hard. And it was all right. I went riding for another 2 hours afterwards, and then I rolled in my sleep a week later and it cracked. So that that was a little brutal. Yeah.
You're nonchalant about it. Clearly, it's not the first broken bone from biking.
Actually, I've been really lucky. I did a collarbone when I was racing when I was 16.
Yeah.
And that was actually when I probably went, okay, I'd rather focus on music. Because I couldn't play guitar for a few weeks. And so that sort of hit home a little bit then. And then I started taking bikes a little less seriously. And then I did fracture my arm about, I'm going to say it was 4 years ago now. And that was a week before a European tour.
Wow.
And I did a lot of physio work and resting to just be able to try and play. I think I had 5 shows through Europe. But they were rough.
Wow.
Yeah. But they also made me play better, funnily enough. Like, that broken arm thing really changed in a moment of sort of how I would approach music, and was really, you know, the start of the process of freeing things up from trying to play everything, and also, yeah, just sort of be more melodic and think about more of the songs I'm writing and how they impact on people, rather than just how many notes can I fit into a bar.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I'm thinking about this last, I mean, this year's been crazy making for all of us, but
yeah,
I'm guessing definitely. You decided to move to LA full time. You found a place, you probably liquidated a lot of your stuff. And now you're back in Australia, about to move into a new house. And I'm guessing, do you have to go back and like buy silverware and stuff?
I don't even know. We've been floating for so long. Like, I know we don't own a lounge. We don't have a refrigerator, things like that. Okay. So, yeah, it's sort of starting from scratch, and it's been a pretty big reevaluation of things. We even like had this discussion sort of just going like around Christmas going, oh, do we keep doing this, or do we just set up life in Australia and just go, okay, you know, let's back away from being a little bit crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so hard, and it's hard. I guess everyone's in a different situation. We're just so happy that we sort of got stuck in Australia through this. Otherwise, we'd just be desperately trying to get back. You know, it's not in things like this. It's not easy to be in a country where you're not a citizen or have like permanent residence yet, which, you know, I have a work visa for the US, but, you know, that does expire in a couple of years still. So it's not like you're there forever and you don't qualify for support or anything. So, at least in Australia, there is that, and our situation here is still pretty good. Like, I've actually done 4 gigs again already.
Wow.
They've been a little bit awkward, but they, you know, it is there and available. And my city is, you know, I remember we had like 3 cases about 5 weeks ago again. So there were hardly any where I live, and then it just, a little thing happened about 5 weeks ago, but nothing has actually eventuated out of that. So it's, you know, it's relatively safe. And I think if you weren't a musician or like in arts and hospitality and things, your life actually probably hasn't changed that much.
Hmm. That's amazing.
Mm.
It's not that way here.
Yeah. No, and it's not that way a lot of the world, and it just depends, like, I know, yeah, the places there are gigs are the places you don't want to go anyway, so it's I'm pretty thankful for that.
Yeah, but. So it sounds like, and there's obviously a lot of variables in America, we don't have to get into them, I don't want to polarize the podcast audience, but
sure,
if looking optimistically, if COVID becomes a thing people aren't worrying about, and the US isn't a stable place, would you still contemplate moving back here, or did this kind of make you realize Australia's home?
Look, Australia's always definitely been home. It's so hard to answer. Like, things would have to change radically. Sure. And, you know, for America, things could still change very radically in the next few months. So. Yeah. I'm quite happy to be.
Yeah, I bet. Take me with you.
Other than missing like so many of my dearest friends and the adventure of it all, it's just I'm hopeful and fearful for the country all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all are.
Yeah.
I mean, are there not, I know you're not right in Sydney, but are there not pockets of cool music and cool music venues there? Is it just that you're kind of on the outskirts, or is Australia just a completely different music scene where groovy improv jazz just doesn't come into play?
Well, there definitely is, but having the venues to support it is hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Sydney only has a, you know, like, as far as a real, like, a jazz venue goes, I think there's only one left officially.
Wow.
There's one that was running, like, a week of its programming a month was jazz. They were a consistent jazz venue, but then it just wasn't working. The people just weren't coming out. It's just a population thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that it's not there. It's just that, you know, the whole country is roughly, what, 26 million people. So it's just, there's just not the population and the media to support getting like anything out of mainstream out there in a lot of ways.
Got it.
But there are definitely cool things happening. It's just there were cool things happening, I should say. How many venues will exist after this is that's the other real sort of kicker of it all, just going like, you know, we might get to the other side, but what venues are going to be left to support music and how's it all going to look? So I'm hopeful about it, but also terrified.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
I know you did the Instagram live stuff. Have you tried, however feebly we can do it these days, to jam with any of the folks back in California via the web?
No, it doesn't work.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah. There's no chance. For the album, we've done a couple of videos, but they're done the hard way, you know, multi-tracked.
Sure.
Record it properly, film, then we all sync it up later. I think that stuff works if you're in the close geographically as well.
Got it.
Like, just works, is my understanding.
There's an extra lag there.
Yeah, the time lag between it's not that cool, you know, feel time lag. It's legit half a bar behind. But, you know, I that's one of the sort of the fun things with the positives to come out of this is that I have upped all my, you know, understanding of video and streaming and, you know, internet connections to try and make all these things better. And I finally bought a camera other than my iPhone to do things. And that's sort of been fun to sort of learn about and, you know, will be more productive in the future. It's a funny sort of web of things. It's also just trying to work out how people actually connect to it is the interesting thing too. And I think it depends on the artist. So for me, it's always been, live things worked best when I could interact with people and just sort of talk to them between things and, you know, say hi when someone tuned in. I sort of like that. And then there are other ones, like the few times I've seen Bill Frisell do things, you know, where he's just sitting in the corner of his room and he starts it and then he just plays for 40 minutes and then he walks awkwardly over to his phone and hits stop. And it's beautiful, but, you know, I don't think I'm quite at that level to just pull that off. I still have to actually talk to people.
You still have to be charming.
Back
and forth.
Well, Bill's so charming just with his, you know, secretly hidden pillows in the background and things.
So are you with the camera purchase, is there going to be a new slew of online content from you?
Who knows. Okay. There's nothing worse than looking at yourself I know. On a video.
I know.
You know, that's why podcasts are so great.
I know. I don't even like hearing myself, though.
I can deal with my voice just now. Yeah. But, yeah, the constant filming is hard. But if that's the only outlet to get music across, and if people appreciate it, then I'll keep trying to do it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
For sure.
I'm definitely more an audio person. Like, I love, you know, listening to albums from start to finish still. And even when someone is live streaming, like, I'd probably rather just listen to it. I can't sit in front of a computer and watch it.
Sure.
That's just how I connect with things. Especially, I think, because most of my listening takes place in cars.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I was thinking you probably have a really fancy stereo to go with all these beautiful guitars you have, but if you're listening in the car, all bets are off.
Look, I've always had like a small studio set up, so I've got some nice Neumann monitors, but I never use them enough for just listening. Mm. When we were moving to the US, I worked out this full awesome recording rig that would fit in a little mono tick bag.
Mm-hmm.
So like I bought, and just cause I knew I wouldn't be able to take things with me and I wouldn't have the money to purchase them for a while. So like I got like the only Bluetooth Bose speakers that are actually stereo. Like it has a little left and right speaker. Oh, and so that with a little Focusrite interface and, you know, a good condenser and a good ribbon mic and, you know, I worked out how I could fit it all into this little mono tick bag, like the size of the little pedal boards. And that was cool. I was sort of excited to just use that as my recording setup from now on. But I'll deal with the big one for a little while longer.
All right. So do you have a lead on the new house already, or are you still looking?
We started looking last night, like rent. It won't be a house. Rent is expensive in Australia.
Sure.
It's just reevaluating everything. For us, it was sort of all eggs went into one basket a little while ago. And so I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but I spent almost 10 years lecturing at a university in Australia, teaching music. And that slowly sort of got phased out through budget cuts to the music program.
Yes, you did. So that was
So part of moving last year was that I actually had no security left. You know, I was just like, oh, well, there's no secure job anymore. And, you know, a job that when I talk to people in society that aren't musicians that they respect, it's like, oh, yes, I'm a university academic. But and that's, you know, that's a whole nother stupid psychological thing, isn't it?
So
everything was like going, moving forward into just going, all right, setting up the music thing so that it was constantly, yeah, it was at a level where we were living off it consistently. And so now to be in a situation where it's housing is pretty important and we don't have one.
Yeah.
It's a bit sad, but I'm doing my best to remain excited about things to come and how it looks, and trying to stay creative in different ways and, you know, take opportunities as they come.
Yeah.
Cuz I think, you know, I can't imagine how it is for so many people. But through lockdown, I still had this album to work on and I was like working super hard. I think I finished like mixing and mastering it like right as the lockdown began, because I had to get it done before moving to the US anyway, because I didn't have access to a studio. So I was trying to get it done here before I left. And then it was all the thing of going, oh, now when do I release it? Sorting out, you know, the publicity, sorting out trying to launch it right. So I had all these things to work on and build towards. And then you know, as we're talking, the album's been out a month. And so, like, as it sort of tapers off a little bit, like, the excitement of that, I'm just going, oh, now what do I do? And I've talked a lot about in the past, like, because I've never had an agent or a manager either. So I've always booked my own shows. So nearly every day there's hours spent researching venues and booking things. And initially, like, not having to do that was amazing. It was like, wow, I finally don't have to check my inbox every day to zero replies.
Sure.
But now I'm like sort of craving that almost. And yeah, I assume musicians everywhere are sort of feeling that even the monotonous things that you hate doing, starting to go, oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind sort of harassing some venues again to see if I can play there.
Yeah. I mean, and it was probably some sort of adrenaline rush to try to learn all this stuff and to try to crack the code on when to put this out and how to time this venue. And yeah, now that's just taken away, and it's like, oh, I could learn how to make sourdough bread, or, you know, I guess ride a bike, but which is fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I have got to do a lot of things, like talking about, you know, little bonuses, and they are going to be direct. These examples are going to be related to you as well. Is that I finally fixed my Fender Champ. So I was always too scared to actually put a soldering iron in an amplifier.
Okay.
And from, you know, listening to the Vintage Amps podcast, I'm like, no, I reckon I can do this. So finally, I replaced the tube socket in my Fender Champ because the power tube had just been falling out because the springs were so bad. So as soon as you play a note, the tube would almost rattle out. So, you know, that's achievement number one.
All right. I'm glad we could help.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
You're still alive. It's good.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was actually thinking about today, which I might talk to you even after the podcast is finished, because you might be able to look at it, is that I've had a digital subscription to the Fretboard Journal for a while now because I didn't have a fixed address that I knew I could get the magazine sent to. So now I can, you know, upgrade my subscription.
Oh, yeah, we'll move it over for you.
Yeah. You know, so I can actually read magazines again instead of trying to look at them on my iPhone.
It's a crazy world. Well, I'm
so
glad.
There's lots of...
Yeah.
There are definitely positives everywhere.
Yeah. Your champ got fixed.
Yeah.
Everything else is up in the air, but your champ got fixed. That's good.
Yeah. And it sounds great now. I'm stoked.
You are one of many Australian listeners to that podcast. I'm not quite sure who all of our Australian amp lover listeners are, but there are a lot of them.
Yeah, I don't know the other four, but...
There are more than four.
Sorry.
Yeah. We just shared the story of the Golden Tone Broadway suitcase. Oh my God, on and on. We get so many letters from Australia. At first it was a novelty thing. I was like, oh, it's a question from someone in Australia. I'll be sure to ask it. Now it feels sometimes like half of the questions are from Australia, which is...
I actually haven't had time I tune in every now and again because I know you put out so many of them, and I haven't been driving as much.
No one has. I mean, I think podcast consumption, especially for me, because I used to drive 2 hours every day, it's gone way down. But it's. I think people in general, their old habits have fallen by the wayside, and I'm guessing listenership across the board with podcasts is probably down.
Yeah. So I'm like, are they asking about Australian made amplifiers? Is that what they're doing?
They were telling us about Australian made amplifiers and it had a unique tube that I won't be able to recite, but
like an SQ
something. It was
something.
A 6GW8 or something. I'm just going to screw it up and even
look I'm pretty
more
sure
like
that is an EL84.
It had a unique tube, but there's the Golden Tone. You know, and then somebody added me to, there's actually a Facebook group for like obscure Australian amplifiers, which,
there's a ton of them. I had a Maton amp, when I was younger. It was one of the first like small powered tube amps I could find. Cause I always wanted like a champ, but they're really hard to find. And, You know, mine actually cost me a fortune. But I, yeah, I found this mate amp years ago, and to find tubes for it, my grandfather, whose name is Bert, and it's actually his 98th birthday today. Oh, I just had birthday. Lunch.
Nice.
Yeah. I just had lunch with him and then raced home to, do this interview. And he restored tube radios. That was his hobby. So he had this whole collection of tubes under his house. And so I would go through and just, find replacement tubes for all my amps, like, Australian made. And I found a box the other day repairing this Champ, actually, where I found like all these Australian made Philips 6V6s and things like that. And just went through and tested them in the Champ because, you know, Skip told me I can do that. And, you know, a couple of them blew up, and then a couple of others smelt really bad, and one worked, and it's still in there.
That's but amazing.
That's, yeah, so he's got this whole vintage tube radio collection, which he's always wanted me to finish restoring, but it's hard because, like, the AM radio network won't exist much longer in Australia, so they'll just pick up static. So
wow.
My long-term plan is probably just to convert all these cool little, you know, wooden box, old tube radios. I can't remember, like, what they are, but I guess is they're just going to get converted into guitar amps at some stage.
That could be your next...
That's the next project.
Yeah. You'll be on Reverb not only looking at stuff to buy, but you'll be selling stuff.
Yeah. 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 Custom-made Australian valve radio amps. Tube radio. Sorry. The Australian term is valve.
Hey, I'm just grateful that we were able to help you, and I'm always in awe of just how many people have checked out that podcast, because it's pretty quirky, but I'm grateful. It seems like it's a podcast for these times where people are trying to, like, do stuff at home and
get electrocuted
and maybe kill themselves. No. Yes. Just end the misery.
Too far. Sorry, that's not what I meant. I just meant accidental electrocution, which I did do the other week, actually, as well, on something else. But that's another story.
With a guitar gear or something?
With a guitar amp, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It was unplugged from the power, but I hadn't drained the caps.
Oh. The mighty death cap.
Yeah. Yep.
Wow. Oh, well.
Dangerous.
Is the 2Rock still your main amp on the record?
I used my classic Reverb signature on the whole album this time.
Okay.
Didn't change it up. It was when I recorded the album in Australia, it was, you know, just still with the apocalyptic year, it was the crazy fires.
Oh, of course. So, yeah.
So it was super hot. Every day, and it was also like, yeah, sort of like the skies in Northern California today, like orange skies, and it just constantly smelled of that. So I was sort of coming into the studio / this bedroom at my parents' place, which is where we sort of got stuck as everything got locked down.
Sure.
I'd just come in for a few hours and just try and get things done quickly. And so I didn't really, once I'd set it up, it just sort of lived in the spot, and I was just trying to get things done, yeah, as quick as possible to keep that live feel. So, you know, if I didn't nail a take, I'd sort of just leave and come back the next day so I could hopefully get it from start to finish.
I was going to say, I mean, this record has an energy and a presence to it that, I know in your heart of hearts, you wanted to re-record the guitar parts, but you did an admirable job making it feel like it was all an intact live session. And that maybe it was a little awkward to have to go and, like, try to revitalize the energy you had back in LA, but you did a great job with it.
Thank you. Well, I've been recording, like, at home since, like, my first album, which is actually out, it is on Spotify and things.
Yeah.
Was recorded on a computer that's like a tenth of the speed of an iPhone. It had 2 gigabyte of hard drive total. And I used to have to go to a local computer store and rent a CD burner to finish it off.
Wow.
Because I didn't have a CD burner in the computer.
Sure.
And so, like, I kind of, all, and, you know, I didn't have enough inputs to record live ever either. So, like, when I was with my band Young, we had four input channels. So, you know, you never could really record live, but I worked so hard on my playing and especially, I guess, listening to what other people were doing to sort of play off them despite it not being at the same time. And I did definitely with this album work super hard on that, you know, just going, or, and, you know, I guess that's the thing of going back in things is that there were certain elements of what I played in LA that I learnt that I was like, well, that bit is great. So I'm going to have to play that every time.
Sure.
So I would go through and actually sort of learn that and get those accents of set so that then when it came to the time to hit record, I'd forget about it, but it would be intuitive.
Sure.
So yeah, it was a lot of work and it basically came, it was a gear thing. Like when I went to LA and this was getting so sucked into the whole LA scene and like, you know, like how amazing Blake Mills is and all those sounds of like fuzzy sort of things. And I bought a new overdrive pedal and a couple of weeks before it, I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is the sound. And I used it over the whole album when I was in LA. And then I got home and went, what was I thinking? Not in a good way. Like I was like, yeah. It just is, you know, I sounded like, you know, the term that goes around LA, the fake Mills.
I don't know that I'd heard that one before, but now I'm glad I have.
Really?
Yeah. I'm up in Seattle. There's no, I mean, we have, I guess a couple of them, but not really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a thing. And, you know, when I've played for other people in Australia, like I can get away with it because not many people know who Blake is.
Sure.
So I could kind of pull that off, especially like when I was playing in other people's bands, because it works so great for that. But yeah, it was a bit too far that way when I'd recorded it. So I came home and, you know, used the pedals I've used for years and the amp I'd used for years. So it was like, yeah, definitely more me. And especially when you're an instrumental artist, it's getting your voice on an instrument where there really isn't that much variation is pretty important.
Yeah. Are you happy with your voice or are you, the, you know, in terms of like your effects pedals and your line, or are you kind of always tinkering with it?
Look, I like tinkering, but I realize that everything sounds the same. Like even I'm going to say like, if someone heard what I'd, the LA version of it, they probably wouldn't have noticed the difference.
Wow.
I was with a friend a few weeks ago and we were talking overdrive pedals. He brought a couple of guitars and around and we're like comparing pickups and things like that. And he was like going, oh, look at your pedals and this and this. And I'm like, yeah, look, you turn them all on. I had four overdrive pedals, all completely different things, completely different architecture. I'd switch them all on and play through them and they all sound exactly the same. And that's, you know, that's just sort of what you got to remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even when I was, so for a long time, like I was only playing acoustic guitar at like all my albums were acoustic guitar solo and then even trio, but on acoustic guitar because I literally could not figure out this stuff. Like I couldn't get myself to sound like me when I played an electric guitar. It always became this, you know, approximation of what I thought the guitar I was playing should sound like.
Hmm.
So I would pick up a Strat and I would, you know, sound like, I would try to sound like Stevie Ray Vaughan or like, you know, John Mayer. Like that's what those guitars sound like. So that's what would happen. And, you know, if I played a 335, I would try to sound like Robin Ford and Larry Carlton. And I couldn't get myself out of that. So I spent years just playing acoustic to really just go, well, what do I sound like before I went back to sort of the electric guitar and take that on? Not that I wasn't playing electric guitar, but I wasn't releasing albums under my own name. on an electric guitar.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then that's how I...
When you went back, was it that parts caster, the first thing that you grabbed?
Yeah. So that was... I was just about to say that. That was the big part of it, is that I wanted to build this guitar that didn't have, like, a preset sound in my head of what it should sound like. So I'd always loved Telecasters, and I'd had a few, and that goes back to Tommy Emmanuel being a Telecaster player, really.
Sure.
But when I built this, it was modeled, so I wanted it to sort of look like one of Frizzell's guitars, actually, which is like, it's got a snake head, but he has some dark wood for the neck. I don't know what it is now. I can't remember. So I wanted it to sort of look like that, but, you know, I put a mini humbucker in it because I'd always just wanted to try this pickup. And I've gone through a few bridge pickups on it over the years now, and two different bridges, maybe three bridges now, just tailoring things. But definitely the combination of woods and that neck hump Firebird pickup, like, just sort of really helped me find a sound that I wasn't thinking about, because the Firebird, and this is going to get nerdy now, the way it's constructed, it's not like a mini humbucker. It's more like two Tele neck pickups side by side. So it's got an Alnico, bar magnets, but they're close to the strings. They're not at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got this attack like a single coil, but it is fatter, and it's really great in how it responds to your dynamics. Like if you play it softer and easier, like that particular guitar can sound like an archtop. When even just turning the volume control down a little bit, just to roll the top end just a touch, and then, you know, with the volume control at full and you smash the low E, it sort of does that Stevie Ray thing as well. So it just was great to be, it sort of responded more like an acoustic guitar. It was like how I hit it would translate through it. And so that was, the biggest part in actually going, oh yeah, I can record albums on electric again.
I love it. Yeah. Who made that Firebird pickup?
It's a Seymour Duncan one.
Yeah. Okay.
And yeah, it's fully mangled. So, you know, I would love to be a luthier, and like we talk about this in my admiration for, you know, the craft of making guitars. But in my traveling and constant things, I'm sort of tool-less. Like, you know, I've never had a garage of cool tools. Yeah. I've got a drill. And so when I got the body for this Tele, it was routed for just a single coil neck pickup. So, you know, I didn't route it out for the mini humbucker. I just drilled it a lot of times to make the hole bigger.
I understand. I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So
I'm taking notes, because I'm going to start my second parts caster project probably next week, and I'm going to be extremely lazy, but I will have a shopping list of pickups and things I need to buy. But I tried the old school way before, and my luthier friend who cleaned up my mess basically said, you know, Jason, I can't believe there's not a single thing on a straight line on this guitar at all. I don't know how you messed up this guitar so much. But it plays well. But for my second attempt, I'm literally just getting wood and sending it to a buddy with a CNC machine.
Play. Mine is sketchy. And so this is the thing. I did this, drilled it out. Then the mini humbuckers, like, they're pretty deep, the legs on them.
Okay.
So in the Seymour Duncan manual, I think it is, I don't want to get them in trouble, whatever. It says to bend the leg of the pickup so it'll fit in a shallower route.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that and the legs broke off.
Got it. So,
and I'm like, well, yeah. So I'm like, well, that sucks. So I just got, I don't know why I had a few pieces of rosewood around. They were like for a head plate that I'd used to make pickup surrounds for something years ago badly as well. And I cut them up, and I super glued them together, and then I super glued the pickup to the top of them, and then I super glued that all into the guitar. So that's my secret.
There you go.
that the neck pickup is actually super glued into the guitar.
Hey, you whatever know, works.
That's my Eric Johnson level equivalent of tone secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're more of an amp we'll tech these that. Days, Adam, so don't yeah, beat exactly. yourself up.
Yeah, I haven't been electrocuted by my Telecaster yet, so but mine turned out amazing. I don't know why it did, and that's why I'm scared to build another parts caster, because I have this really high expectation of how good it'll turn out now. Sure. And I think this might have been a fluke.
Well, but one day until you try.
Yeah, people keep asking me to make them ones, and I yeah, it's just look, when you're friends with Ken Parker, how can you go, yeah, I'll make you a guitar? Like, you just can't do that stuff. Yeah.
Do you still have the Ken Parker? Or do you have to give that back?
I tried stealing it and crossing borders. Yeah. No. I'm
sorry.
No, that's, yeah. Yeah. It's, no, is the simple answer. And, you know, it's, I don't know. They're definitely, as far as like, yeah, guitars go, they're the one that you can super justify the value in, I think. Because it's just the amount of work and the tonal design and the things, the way it plays when you actually get to the end is incredible. So, but yeah. No, I didn't manage to steal that back to Australia.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's fine.
If you had, there's no way he could even come after you.
No. Although Ken is a keen boatsman. I don't know.
That's true.
So, you know, actually, because he is a good friend, he's like, yeah, well, we'll just sail and meet you. I'm like, how are you going to do that? Go around? He's like, no, we'll just drive to LA and then get in the boat. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Had no idea.
Yeah, that'd be a fun exercise.
Yeah, we got to get GoPros on that. That's our next Fretboard yeah. film.
Yeah.
Adam, this album is incredible. I mean, it's been a thoroughly weird year where, to be honest, only a handful of albums have really stood out because I'm just like everybody else walking around like a zombie and feeling kind of numb to the world. But I have to say, I've listened to this record endlessly and I thoroughly love it. And it sounds fantastic. I'm thoroughly shocked that you went and re-recorded all the guitar parts. I'm still trying to process that, but yeah. You fooled me. So that's good.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, I toyed with not telling people this, but I just have to be honest.
No, you obviously made the right decision. It sounds fantastic. I haven't heard the other version, but I encourage everybody to go check it out. It's on all the streaming platforms and everything else. Anything else we should talk about before we sign off here?
No, I think that's really it. I just have to sort out my subscription.
Well, we will we will fake sign off and I'll sort out your subscription. Yeah. I look forward to your new mountain biking instruction channel on YouTube with that camera you just got. And
And that's going to be amazing.
Business. Yeah.
Yeah. Amp Tech, Telecaster building. It's all going to be happening soon as musicians diversify throughout the world.
It's funny and it's also really sad. So.
Yeah. Yep. We'll stay positive.
All right.
It's all right. I'm hearing the fade out music right now.
Thanks, Adam. That was great.